Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know that this podcast is presented by mybookie.ag and that if you use the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, that you will get a 50% deposit bonus on your first deposit. And given that you are a listener to this podcast, I would assume you're relatively knowledgeable about sports, and I would trust you to try your edge on the online sportsbook. You can lay down some money and get in on the action at one of the safest online sportsbooks in the world. It's the only one that I am currently using. You can wager on all sorts of different outcomes on mybookie.ag, soccer, football, any major league, esports. You can even create your own player props, which is useful for me because if you know anything about me, I do enjoy a good player prop. So if you deposit using the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, you get a 50% bonus when you deposit. And I will add this for listeners of the TakeCast. If you deposit using the promo code MATTEK and you send proof of it to me on Twitter, I will follow you on Twitter and you can have access to me via DMs whenever you want. That's the TakeCast bonus that I'm adding in association with the mybookie.ag deposit bonus. Now let's get back to the show. Everyone, and welcome to the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. The guest in this episode is Rufus Peabody, who you can find on Bet the Process and at MasseyPeabody.com. Rufus came on the show to talk a little bit about what it's like to be a pro bettor, you know, a little bit of his methodology, not giving too many secrets away, as well as his experience with the Sports Betting National Championship. I think that you guys will really like what he had to say about his experience there, and I think you guys will be able to learn a little bit from him, and of course, you will also be able to support the show if you would like. You can leave a rating and review on iTunes at any time. That's always very appreciated, and Rufus and I did a little bonus 10-minute episode that will be able to be found on the Patreon feed for the show. For just $5 a month, you get bonus episodes of the show, access to our sub-only Discord, and all of the Showdown Slate podcasts that you can handle. You can find that on www.patreon.com/takecast. And after a quick ad, we will get into the show. Hey guys, I just wanted to take a moment out from the show to tell you about our proud sponsor, DailyRoto.com. You guys know that I have joined up forces with DailyRoto and Roto Experts full-time and wanted to communicate to you a little bit about their golf product. Of course, with your premium subscription to DailyRoto, you get their amazing NFL, NBA, and MLB tools. They have also partnered with DataGolf to provide the best customizable projections for PGA DFS, as well as outright top 5 and top 20 betting. Using their tools, you can calculate the EV for outright top 5 and top 20 bets, as well as create the best and most customizable projections for PGA Daily Fantasy in the industry. You can save 10% on your subscription using the promo code RORY right now. And now back to the show. All right, everyone, would like to welcome in Rufus Peabody of Massey Peabody and Bet the Process onto the show. Rufus, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. A little tired and exhausted after a week of prop betting, but I'm here.
There we go. So normally with guests on the show, I love to get a sense of how people ended up here. And so my question to you is, did you like sports or math first? Which came first in your line of work?
That's a good question. I think they both came at about the same time. I've always been into the numbers side of sports, and my mom used to tell the story about how I would buy the Washington Post on my way to school when I was in first grade, and I would read the box scores for baseball games, and I didn't even know how to read yet, so. Yeah, it was. I think they both occurred around the same time when I was young.
Yeah, I mean that's I feel like that's kind of how a lot of people got into it, was they just really enjoyed reading the paper, which is something that's so foreign to our experience now. But that was how I first started reading about and like becoming aware of sports. I read the sports section of our local paper every morning. I think a pretty interesting question though, with people who are very heavily involved in the math side of fantasy sports and gambling, is how you arrived at football kind of being your main sport, despite the, you know, the really inherent problems with football translating to math. It's the hardest game to assign individual credit. So how did you arrive at football being your kind of main gambling sport?
Well, I think it's pretty simple, actually. And that's just that football is the biggest market out there. Baseball was actually the sport that I initially got into. I did my senior thesis on psychological inefficiencies in the baseball betting market. But moving to Las Vegas after college, you know, football is the big betting market. And the thing is, everybody's working with the same information. So it's not just hard for me, it's hard for everyone. And baseball is easier to quantify for everyone as well. So I think that there are some real edges there if you can think about things creatively.
Do you feel that overall that football lines of like the four major sports are the least efficient if you have like a good mathematical or modeling background?
No, I actually think they are the most efficient just because it is the biggest market. But the advantage is you're able to bet more. So smaller edges, but more volume.
Right, like the biggest edges are probably on props, but the limits for props are super low, especially, I assume an experience you've had plenty of times is books no longer taking your action.
Yeah, or just cutting your limits. That's the big thing, and making it just not worth your while. But, you know, you read about, you know, Darren Revelle or someone else tweeting that, you know, this person placed a $400,000 bet on this, and those people that are able to place bets like that are generally big casino players, and they're not winning bettors, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I'm someone who, you know, my background is really a lot of like fantasy gaming, so I'm learning a lot of this stuff right now for the first time. But like, what would the experience be of a casino limiting your action? Like, you literally go up to the window to place a bet, and they say, you know, the max you can do is 10K. I assume you and a lot of the pro sports bettors like have relationships with the sports books. Like, they you guys know each other on a kind of personal level.
Yeah. So the Westgate is one where they'll take my action, that they will give me house limits on things, but an average Joe might be able to get a little bit more than I would. I'll be able to bet $2,000 on a prop bet there, just like everybody else. But you know, I wanted to bet a halftime there during the, I think it was one of the championship games, and I pulled it up on the app. I was in the Westgate Sportsbook, and they would only take $500 from me on that. And so that's a sort of a common thing. And a few years ago, I was betting props, and I was waiting for these William Hill props to come out. William Hill props tend to be the most mispriced. If you can bet the openers, there's some real gravy there. But I'm there. I happen to be at the counter right when that sheet comes out. And it's like Christmas morning, and I go up to bet, and they're like, "Sorry, we can't take your action anymore." And for me, it wasn't just the fact that they couldn't take my action anymore; it was the timing of it, the fact that I didn't have a backup plan in place. I didn't have anybody else that could go and, you know, bet for me or anything like that. So it can be quite frustrating at times. But.
Yeah, and there's a sense of trying to be at the right casino at the right time when these like softer lines come out before, and I mean a lot, I guess probably an experience you've had is the line moves after you place a bet on something.
Yes, and for props, lines move a ton. So you know, you could see, I mean, I think a lot of these sheets are available online, for example, like the South Point, and I saw someone on Twitter was quoting South Point prices. Say, oh, this is a great prop bet. And, you know, they were looking at openers, and there was, I think, for example, no roughing the passer opened at plus 130 on the no, and that should be priced closer to like, you know, 2-1 underdog than, yeah, to have a roughing the passer penalty. So, you know, I bet that all the way up to like minus 150, minus 160, I believe. And so you do see some lines that are quite mispriced, but they do not last long at all.
Yeah. So you are definitely one of the few people who's able to win at a quite a good clip to call yourself a pro sports bettor. And a lot of what you talk about is football. The Massey Peabody site has a lot of really good, football information. You guys post a lot of the picks from your model on the website, futures and everything. But I know that you do some golf betting, and that's of real interest to me because I'm like a lifelong golf betting fish, though I have hit... Yeah, I've had a couple hits that have left me in plus EV territory lifetime. But without divulging too much and giving away, your edge and what goes into your math model, I would love to get your take on course history. Guys, Zach Johnson at the John Deere, Bubba at the Travelers, kind of what is your overall opinion on course history for predicting future success?
Well, I don't like talking too much about golf, but course history definitely matters. And I think, but I don't think it necessarily matters in the way everybody thinks it does. There are certain things that, I think there are courses that fit golfers' eyes well. Like the Travelers isn't something that you would expect Bubba, it isn't a course you'd expect Bubba to be that much better, or you wouldn't expect him to be that, to play that well there relative to all these other courses, but he does.
Right.
But I think what matters more is how the course fits a particular player's style. And so, I can have a golfer that hasn't played a course ever, but I think that the course will suit him really well because of, X, Y, and Z about, his stats and the way he attacks courses in general.
Right. So are there kind of specific bet types that you think casual bettors would have more success on or more of an edge? Like, I think what a lot of people do is they choose to bet outrights, but obviously outrights over the long run, you're just going to put in a lot of negative EV money, whereas in, top 20s, head-to-heads, or three balls, you're able to extract more value. Do you have any thoughts on those golf betting types?
Well, hopefully you're not putting out negative EV bets in general. I mean, you can put out plenty of losing bets, but that doesn't mean they're negative EV. I have a particularly I've been particularly good over the years at betting on guys to get second place. So way too many Sergio Garcias and Jim Furyk bets. But I think, the bulk of it is matchup bets for me. So that's just because that's where you can get the most money down.
Yeah, and are there similar limits to betting on golf head-to-heads for you the same way that there would be for betting player props? Like, if there's just very obviously a bad head-to-head line, do you find that those get moved or that you get limited on those as well?
I don't want to get too much into the mechanics of betting the golf as much.
Yeah. No, that's cool. So have you thought much about playing PGA DFS? Because there actually is more of a crossover between betting golf and playing DFS than there is kind of for any other DFS sport and betting.
I've thought about it, and actually I think it was 5 or 6 years ago. I did it for a month or two, but it's just very labor intensive. I had to look and see. What I was most interested in doing was the sort of head-to-heads or these, quote, cash games rather than the tournaments, just because it wouldn't require any additional work for me or not as much additional work to change my projections to a projected DFS score. And then I can, basically maximize fund lineups to maximize the DFS score. But if I'm going to play a $10,000 contest to get somebody, I want to have an idea of how optimal their lineup is going to be as well. And so you have to do a little bit of research on the guys you're up against. And my general take is that, while I didn't think all these guys playing for $10,000 were creating optimal lineups, I don't know, the edges weren't that huge given the rake, and the edges are much bigger on these sort of smaller money games, but it just requires a lot of effort to put those all in,
So right. Yeah.
For me, DFS is just, it's just too labor intensive.
So do you just, you just like don't really play much DFS at all? I actually don't know the answer to this question.
Yeah. At this point, I don't play DFS at all. I haven't for more than 5 years.
No, oh, that's I mean, that's pretty interesting. I think a lot of people I think believe that DFS is much easier than betting in terms of like the time involved, actually.
Really?
Yeah, just because there's like no cost, there's no time cost in getting money down. Like you can enter in, you know, $30,000 worth of games in 30 minutes. And if you're just using, you know, one lineup, like we were talking about with PGA, like one optimized lineup, the best combination of like cut percentage optimized to like DraftKings projections, you can enter that lineup in, and then you can enter in, you know, kind of infinite contests in like 30 minutes. I think that's the attitude that a lot of people have about DFS, is that the time cost is actually relatively low.
For me, it's kind of more akin to prop betting, though, because you do have to consider what other people are doing, too.
Right.
And, well, actually, you don't do that for prop betting, but prop betting, you have to keep up with the injuries and all that stuff. And so, I mean, normally, my golf projections are pretty automated. I have a model, and what I do on a given week doesn't require much thought. It's basically all the back-end work has been done. And so, I like that I can just do that, and then, I mean, just go through these matchups, find where the value is, run 300,000 simulations of the tournament, like, you know, and just put the bets there. So, I mean, you're right. It doesn't seem like that much more work, I guess, for the DFS, but I don't know. For me, I think that here's the thing. Let's say DraftKings doesn't price these golfers very accurately.
Yeah.
If that's the case, you're going to find a bunch, you know, and let's say there's a bunch of other people that are at least semi-sharp, you know, playing PGA DFS. They'll probably all like a lot of these same guys because they're the ones that are undervalued.
Yeah, right? I mean that definitely is true. There's a ton, like at the higher stakes of anything, whether it be NFL, NBA, PGA, there's going to be a ton of overlap. There's just going to be a lot of guys who, like, you know, Hideki Matsuyama is underpriced relative to his outright odds. He's going to be 80% owned amongst like high stakes regulars or whatever. So that definitely does diminish the edge at the higher stakes. And at the point in which you're playing like $5 head to heads on DraftKings, like it's probably honestly not worth even like the 30 minutes it would take to set up those games.
Exactly. And as the pricing becomes more accurate, you know, then your true edge to your, like, to your handicapping actually goes down. And so I feel like, in a way, I mean, and what's the rake there? Somebody told me it's minus 125.
I guess it would depend on the game type, but yeah, like the DraftKings Sportsbook, not very good rake. The DraftKings, like DFS game rake, it would depend on the game. Actually, the rake at the higher games is a little bit less, like a $10,000 head-to-head game is raked a little bit less than like a $20 head-to-head game is.
Okay.
So they do give a discount to people who are willing to put more action in. But in general, yeah, the biggest enemy of like the common DFS player is going to be the rake. Like a lot of people might be able to win at like a 50% clip or whatever, but not enough to beat the rake.
Right, just like sports betting.
Right, exactly. So before we move on from golf, the PGA DFS community, I mean, there's a lot of guys that we've punted on over the years. Luke List is the current hot one right now that we just keep losing outright bets on. Are there any guys that are just total bogeys for you that have cost you more money than they've made you?
Plenty. At least on outrights, Jim Furyk and Sergio Garcia come to mind the most. But Luke List is definitely one as well.
Yeah.
What I hate is when you bet somebody that's relatively unknown for a while and under the radar, and they come really close a bunch of times, and then the public realizes who they are, and there's suddenly no value in betting them, and then they finally win. And so I guess the best example for me is Kyle Stanley at Torrey Pines in 2012, I believe it was, which I don't know if you remember this, Farmers Insurance Open. He had a 6-stroke lead heading into the final round, and he had either 2 or 3-stroke lead going into the final hole. All he needed was Yeah, no, three-stroke lead. All he needed was a double bogey to win. And Brant Snedeker, who was in second place, had already finished. And so, you know, 18 at Torrey Pines is the easiest hole on the course, generally.
Right.
Kyle Stanley, you know, he laid up, sitting 100 yards out in the fairway in two. He could have used his putter and gotten a double bogey from there. But, you know, he hits this beautiful shot that he overspins it, goes back into the pond, like, then hits it over the green, chips to 3 feet, misses his three-footer, and suddenly it's a triple bogey, and then he loses on the second playoff hole after Snedeker hits one off the grandstand and bounces back onto the green. And so it was pretty bad. Like, my partners and I stood to win $150,000 on Kyle Stanley outright. Fast forward to the next week, and we have Spencer Levine, the little short chain smoker.
Yep, I do. I'm well aware. Yeah.
He had I don't know how this happened back to back weeks, but he had a 6-stroke lead going into the final round of the Phoenix Open and ended up blowing that, and Kyle Stanley got the win. Like, it was this great story of redemption according to the media, and I was like, I got screwed twice.
Yeah, and you were just tilting, saying if he would have just made the 3-footer, then this would all be different.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's golf. I think golf provides, like, the best bad beat stories out of any sports, because there are so many like that where the guy just has to make a 10-footer or whatever. There's actually a big one in the DFS community with the Dustin Johnson, Jordan Spieth, U.S. Open. One of the guys in our community, his name is Dave Kaplan. He was set to win one of the first DraftKings Millionaire Makers for PGA if Dustin made, I think it was, like, the 8-footer to send it, and you know, of course he three-putted that, and so you know, one of our guys that we all know lost the first DraftKings Millionaire Maker on Dustin not being able to putt on 18.
That was a costly missed putt for me as well.
Yeah, that was, I mean, Dustin is a guy that it's definitely a favorite of the metrics community, but changing focus a little bit here. So I look at the Massey Peabody picks every week before I place any bets, before I make picks for any sort of contest or you know, anything like that. And I do have a small question about methodology, and if you don't want to get too far into it, totally cool with me. But I've always wondered how you guys deal with coaching inside of your methodology, because for me as an outsider, that kind of feels like the hardest thing to quantify into an actual number and to predict the future success or failures of, like, coaching decisions.
No, you're right. It is difficult. And it's something I don't think we have a perfect solution to. I think in general, a lot of the coaching stuff, at least game planning and all that stuff, sort of is reflected in the statistics, you know. But if you're talking about the in-game coaching, the, you know, fourth down decision making, that kind of thing, the areas where the Eagles excel, for example, and where Sean McVay has not been that great.
Dirty little secret. Sean McVay kind of a wimp with his fourth down play calling.
Totally. Yeah, that's something that we don't directly account for it, but in terms of but it is, I guess, indirectly accounted for in terms of a team scoring efficiency. So it's an area where the Patriots have been good for many years and other teams haven't. So I guess it's like asking, how do I account for teams, you know, being more penalty prone and things like that. It's sort of indirectly accounted for in this sort of the scoring efficiency, which is kind of a catch-all that gets a lot of other components that are not necessarily reflected in individual play yardage and success.
Yeah. So this is not on our agenda, but just while we were talking, I'm reminded of this. Something that came up a lot this year with your guys' lines is you guys had picks on a lot of the massive dogs, like when the Cardinals were 15-point, like, home or road dogs, when the Buffalo Bills would be 13-point dogs. And I guess the question would be, I feel like those bets ran kind of bad this year. And do you think that there is anything to be adjusted in the future with how pass heavy teams are going, and maybe the teams that are 14-point dogs, it's maybe more accurate for them to be that dogged given how much teams are scoring now?
That's a good point. I mean, I do, given that, you know, if a team is a certain, like, let's say a team that's 10 points better based on, you know, 40 points scored in a game, they're going to be probably more points better if you're expected to have 60 points in that game. Is that the point you're making?
Right. Yeah. That's the exact point I'm making.
Yeah. So that's something that I generally do adjust for. So with the higher total that, you know, at least for my own betting, the Massey Peabody ratings, we just, you know, what I give out there is literally just basically the difference in ratings.
Right.
But, yeah, so hold on 1 second.
No worries.
For me, that's a very good point you bring up, but it is something that I use a lot more in college football, because that's where it really makes a difference, because you see much bigger differences in sort of in terms of game totals.
Yeah.
Like you have like an Oklahoma game, you know, versus like Texas Tech that's going to have 75 points versus like, you know, the Army Navy game where, you know, the total was like 37. You know, if one team, the differences are going to be magnified.
Yeah, and that, like, just in college, there are going to be teams that are favored by, like, 39 points or whatever, and, like, that's hard to tell if it's an accurate line. I tend to think that, like, the massive dog teams are, in general, are, like, relatively good bets, but definitely something that burned me a couple times this year. So we have to turn now to the Sports Betting National Championship. If you happen to be listening to this and you don't know, Rufus was in first place of the DraftKings Sports Betting National Championship after the Patriots covered versus the Chargers, but his bet was not graded in time to allow him to wager on the final game. So you finished in third place for $330,000, but you were denied the opportunity to place a wager, which could have put you in first place for $1 million. So obviously massive controversy about this, because other bet types were graded earlier, and certain people were able to go up to the window and get theirs manually graded. So rewinding a little bit, what was the experience like, and what was your strategy like before the controversy? Because to me, the way that the whole thing was set up is it really seemed like an exercise in game theory, kind of more than just the ability to accurately predict sports results.
I completely agree with that. It wasn't a sports handicapping contest in any way, shape, or form. It was, you know, much like, I guess, winning the World Series of Poker isn't about being the best poker player. Probably it's about getting lucky and having a good strategy and mostly getting lucky. And for me, it was about mostly getting lucky. Although I do think there were some edges there, given how conservative a lot of the participants were. So I went in with the strategy that I tried to reverse engineer where I would need to get to. And I thought overall going into it that the winner would be somewhere north of 100,000, probably south of 150,000, somewhere in that range.
Yeah.
Just based on how many people there were and how many you know, people taking shots. So, you know, if you think about it, if, you know, if everybody was playing kind of optimally and taking a bunch of shots with parlays and big money lines, you're going to have some people that inevitably get up, you know, reach that number. And so my thought was, if I could get up to that sort of $30,000 to $50,000 range going into the last day, going into Sunday, I would have a chance because I could to double up twice and get to that number. And so I tried to I didn't really do much the first day. The second day, I tried to find some parlays that would get me into that range because there weren't really any money lines that were really big enough with edges to do that. So I found some golf bets and parlayed that with some football stuff and some hockey stuff and had a bunch of, it had like five or six different parlays that would hit, if they hit, would put me in that range. And one of them ended up hitting, which is nice. And actually two, and almost a third that, you know, I think there was one that came down to, it was a six leg parlay. By the way, I got very lucky that these parlays hit. These were, you know, I had edges on them, but the edges are not huge.
Right.
And, you know, so for one of them, I think all I needed was Ches Reavie to win his, it was a sort of a six-way, six group or six person group bet. You know, if he'd won that, like all the every other leg had hit, and so that would have actually put my bankroll over at 100,000 right then. But he was 5 under at the turn, but he bogeyed 3 straight on the back nine and ended up, I think, finishing with 2 birdies, but I think was a few back of, I forget who it was. Someone kind of went crazy in that group and shot 7 under, so.
Yeah, and I actually undershot what the final winning score would be. It was hard for me to imagine anyone really running it up that high. Like I thought the winner would kind of be, I thought it would be more in like the $50,000 range. But a lot of people, you know, obviously did a lot of parlays, and some people really hit the college basketball games on that Friday really hard, which I think like shifted the projection of what the winning score would be because so many people hit those games hard. Did you do any of the college basketball lines?
I didn't, not a single one. I mean, I thought of it this way. Like, let's say you have all these people betting 20 to one shot, you know, so, like a bunch of people, like, and with their entire bankroll, you know, somebody's going to hit. Well, actually you would think like 10 people would hit, right?
I mean, yeah, if I don't even know, there were what, like 250 people participating, something like that. So
yeah.
if 200 people all bet 20 to ones, you know, if the math would just work out that, you know, 20 of those people, 30 of those people would hit, and then the leaderboard would like shift pretty dramatically. So like that was the first thing after that first day. I was like, oh no, it's going to take way more to win this. So we're a couple weeks out from this now. We're actually about a month later. So with that longer lens, what do you actually think DraftKings' critical error was? Was it just a lack of foresight in general, or just like, you know, the ability to not understand that one of the games might run long or might go to overtime? Was it just like poor planning in that way?
Well, I think the contest, well, I think it was a great idea. I think the organization was kind of bad in general. You know, it was so difficult to actually sign up. It took me 48 hours from the time I sent an email to try to sign up to the time I actually got signed up. And I had to keep emailing, and they were not very responsive. And I was trying to give them money, you know. So,
they were really trying to get money too. Like everyone who had played DraftKings, like they were sending out crazy emails. They were offering discounts. They were really trying to fill this thing up. So that's surprising to me.
Yeah, I just think it wasn't very well organized. It seemed like they were figuring out as they went along. And, you know, you're right. I think they realized that it could be an issue beforehand. We got an email, the Patriots game running long could be an issue because we did get an email about it. But they also did say that there would be this cash out option available. And so I figured, you know, the biggest Patriots -3.5 is going to be that's a pretty big market. That's one where I would expect that cash out option to actually be available. And I'd expect it to be the first thing graded after the game. What I didn't expect was that people would get prop bets graded in the second quarter before the game was official. It would be more than 5 minutes after the game ended that my Patriots bet was graded. And I think that, to me, I don't think that was a reasonable outcome at all. I don't, even given that the game went long, I mean, I've never, you know, they've insisted to me that their technology worked the way it was supposed to work. And this is Kambi in Sweden that does this for them, but the regular processes were followed. But to me, that it just seems ludicrous that it would take that long for the biggest market to settle. I've never really had that experience anywhere else.
Well, it is. I mean, it is bizarre that like some of the props were graded out. Like I think the Tyrell Williams receiving prop and the Sony Michel rushing prop, like those being graded out. That has to just be an error on their part. Like that, I don't. That can't happen, right?
I agree, because at that point the game isn't official yet. I mean, if you know something happens to delay or postpone the game, those bets wouldn't be official. But also, it isn't like the first touchdown bet in which, you know, where, you know, you can't get a negative touchdown afterwards. Even, I mean, what could happen is something could happen and the game isn't official, but these are over under props, and you can lose yards receiving and rushing. Sonny Michel could, Belichick could decide at the end of the game to have him run backwards and run out the clock and take an intentional safety, you know? So,
right, yeah.
I mean, it's unlikely, but it is something that isn't completely out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah. So overlay was definitely a motivating factor for a lot of people entering. But overlay aside, do you think that there is like a future and edge in peer-to-peer betting formats? Because I actually kind of think maybe that's a decent future for sports betting and the industry in the United States, where the more creative the format gets to get people entering their money into the betting ecosystem, like the better. But a lot of these people are going to, you know, just most of these people are going to lose. They're not going to be able to beat the rake. Do you have any thoughts on what types of formats would be pretty compelling as betting markets in the United States evolve?
So this doesn't relate to the contest in general, but I think an exchange really is the future, or at least I hope it is, because I think the big issue with someplace like DraftKings and a bunch of other books is that they follow this European model, which basically is that they want to take a lot of action from recreational bettors, and they want, but equally important is identifying sharp bettors and cutting them off. And so you have this completely underserved population of people, these sharp bettors, and some of which, you know, some of whom are probably just break even bettors. We're not even talking about people that are doing this for a living necessarily, but people that are betting lots of underdogs or betting a bunch of props or basically profiling as at least semi-sharp. And so, you know, a betting exchange makes the most sense for people like me, I guess, because, you know, you can, well, the operator isn't actually taking a position on the game. It's like a poker table. They're just taking a rake. And so I think that's something that would be, I think that's something a lot of people are interested in. Unfortunately, that model hasn't really been successful. You know, Matchbook tried it. Betfair is having some financial difficulties with that. I think their actual sports book is doing a lot better than their exchange. But because the big problem with that is that your average recreational bettor doesn't understand the way an exchange works as much. It's a little more difficult. And, you know, as an American too, I mean, you're seeing things in like decimal odds, and it's a little bit different. But and I think as it is like right now, I mean, the exchanges are probably about half sharps and half bookmakers trying to lay off action. So
yeah.
But I don't know. I'm bullish on the idea. I think we need this. We need a. It's not going to happen until there's a better federal framework for sports betting in place where you can transmit information across state lines. And with the reinterpretation of the Wire Act recently, it seems like we're going in the wrong direction there, but I'm still hopeful. I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I'm pretty hopeful too, but I do think that some company, some venture capitalist, some whatever, there has to be a solution to not bleeding the stone completely dry. And I don't know what that solution is, and I don't know what the eventual game type will be, but there does have to be a way to make it, you know, kind of more frictionlessly peer-to-peer as opposed to people just betting straight against the book. Like, I think that's kind of the bottom line for, like, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, to me, I think that's literally exactly what an exchange is. It like, makes so much sense. Like, why shouldn't it work?
Yeah, just because people aren't smart enough to figure it out, and the legality is questionable right now. But I do agree with you, that's, like, a pretty good future forecast of what things might be.
Right, and then the other problem is you can't really parlay things on an exchange.
People love their parlays. Yeah, no doubt.
True.
So the Super Bowl, do you hold any futures? Will you and Massey have a play?
So I do hold futures on the Patriots that I placed earlier in the season. Surprisingly, I think hopefully
after they lost to Detroit, that was maybe the most tilting game of my entire life.
No, it was the middle of the season, middle to late. Price is just, I think there was this perception that the Patriots weren't that good. And, you know, I thought they were a little better. So, will Matthew Peabody have a play? I think we probably will have a play on the Rams. we definitely have value in the Rams at this point. I've been waiting to see some threes pop up, and I've pounced a little bit when threes have popped up because I do have these Patriots futures. I'm willing to take a big position on the Rams plus three, and you know, hopefully the Patriots win by two, and I'm very happy in that case.
Yeah, they win by two. You're a very happy dude.
Yeah.
So we got to talk a little bit about prop bets before I let you go. Kind of what is your overall strategy? What kind of props do you gravitate towards? Like, I assume you're not doing very many of like the super silly ones, like, you know, what color Gatorade, but it's more yardage, reception, carry sort of props.
Right. And you can't even bet the what color Gatorade in the state of Nevada. You can only bet things that are, you can, I guess, get from the NFL's official data on the game. So from the game book. So I basically try to project out everything, and I got my start, I guess, doing props many, many years ago. And that was, I would be betting props every week. And at this point, I'm really only doing it once a year. So it's a lot of work, and I don't know if the juice is worth the squeeze at this point, just because I have to kind of revisit my methodology every year, and feels like, it's always hard when you don't notate your code well enough. I'll say that. It motivates me to be a little bit better with that. But I'm betting both player props and game props. Things like, will there be a 2-point conversion? You know, James White's longest reception. You know, his first reception length. All sorts of things like that. Will C.J. Anderson score a touchdown? No. Quite a lot of that. C.J. Anderson scores a touchdown, I lose $50,000, I think.
Wow. We are shorting C.J. Anderson officially.
Well, it's more about the prices I got. Because that's one where, you know, you're not going to use some sort of statistical model to be able to perfectly predict the usage of C.J. Anderson versus Todd Gurley. I think everybody is kind of mystified at what's going on and how hurt
definitely
is Todd Gurley.
Yeah.
And why is he saying these things that are, you know, that he, you know, he played sorry and didn't deserve to actually be out there and things like that. Yeah. So I didn't want to actually have that big a position on C.J. Anderson, just given the fact that it's less math and more an opinion, I guess. Although it is math, but I made a judgment call on what percentage of carries he's going to get and what, you know, what percentage of carries inside the 5-yard line and, you know, things like that. But I just thought the price seemed kind of off, but it is one where there's a lot of uncertainty. So that's something I tend to want to avoid, big positions where it's based on an opinion rather than based on something more mathematical.
Right. So finally, last thing, you've been pretty critical at times of the sports betting media landscape with, I think, good cause. There are obviously a lot of fraudsters out there, and you've actually even launched your own podcast, Bet the Process, to try and engage with and educate sports bettors. What are your goals for that podcast moving forward? And how do you think that overall the media climate can better improve betting content?
So first off, the goals for the Bet the Process podcast, I guess, is to sort of educate bettors and to sort of be able to take deep dives into some things that neither Jeff nor I were able to do when we were at ESPN. I think the big thing there was we had to have quick sound bites and sort of tell people what to think rather than how to think. And I think that's kind of what we try to do, sort of say, okay, this is how, like, get people into the sort of framework of thinking and what our process is, I guess. But I also, but in terms of the media landscape overall, I think it's really difficult. And I don't really have the answer there, because the question is, what is betting content? And people want picks. They want to buy picks. And Massey Peabody, it's picks that drive people going to that site, which that wasn't our intention. And it's not my favorite thing to do, because it's, I don't know. But I think that you're going to see some issues with things like, you know, the Action Network, and I mean, where I don't know what they're trying to be at this point. And I think they're trying to figure it out too. I mean, they have certain things that are tools for bettors. Like they, you know, Sports Insights does a bunch of trends and things like that, that are actually trying to help bettors. We're sometimes critical of those, but that's sort of one area of a focus for them, while another is seems to be more just entertainment, like guys like Paul Wojcicki, who are down like 1,000 units on betting, and nobody would say they're sharp bettors, but that they're talking about their gambling stories and creating just sort of this entertainment. So I think that's, and obviously they keep hiring people like that, so there is an appetite for that, but it's definitely hard to create content that helps the average bettor without it's hard to create content that helps the average bettor and is sustainable, because if you do help, I mean, it's just like selling picks. You know, if you're good at it, you're going to end up moving the market, and people aren't going to end up getting that value they once did, because you're going to cannibalize your own user base. You know, people move the market, and most people are left not getting, getting the sloppy seconds, not being able to get in at a good price. And so, I think it's a huge issue, and I don't really know where it's going to go. What do you think?
I do think that actually a lot of what is going to happen over the next, I would guess, probably 5 years, is I think, unfortunately, a lot of it is going to kind of be that entertainment stuff and selling picks. There are going to be people who market themselves as winners when they are not winners, or they are betting non-sharp lines or things like that, because there is no real verifiable way to prove if someone is a winner or loser. And this is something that's existed in sports betting for a long time, where people post picks against lines that you can't even really get. And I guess there is sort of this interesting thing where in DFS you can pretty much figure out if someone is a winner or a loser. If someone is a winner, they're going to be playing in higher stakes games. You're going to see them, you know, at the top of tournaments. And there really is not as easy of a way to verify that in sports betting. And I kind of think that we're in a Wild West period of sports betting content right now. And unfortunately, the sort of bet the process model, or the people who are trying to educate, it's just not as flashy to the average consumer as the, look, we're up 10 units this week sort of thing is. And yeah, I kind of think right now the overall environment is sort of bad and negative for, like, you know, average Joe who wants to just bet on some games.
I agree. You make good points.
Yeah. All right, so tell people where to find you, where to listen to the podcast, and about the Massey Peabody site.
Okay, so the Massey Peabody site, first off, is something that I started with my former senior thesis advisor, Cade Massey, who at the time was a professor at Yale, and now he's a professor at Wharton. And so we post our, basically Massey Peabody, we do college football and NFL ratings, and we post picks based off of those ratings for the NFL. We used to do that for college football. We still do for bowl games, but it ended up hurting value in future weeks, and I have to protect my livelihood, so don't do that anymore. But so Massey-Peabody.com is that site. You can find the Bet the Process podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You know, iTunes is where I get mine. And then you can follow me on Twitter at Rufus Peabody.
There we go. All right, thanks for joining.
Thanks a lot, Davis.